You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think you're going to actually love this podcast. It's with Dr. Marissa Porges, who's known for her work on leadership, education, and national security. All right, so those things. She's currently the head of the Baldwin School, which is a 130-year-old all-girls school outside of Philadelphia. Prior to joining Baldwin, she served in the Obama White House, and she was a visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and at the Council on Foreign Relations, where her research focused on worldwide counterterrorism efforts. She served in the U.S. Navy as one of 8 female aviators in an air wing of about 200. She graduated from Harvard, earned her doctorate from King's College in London, and her book is called What Girls Need, How to Raise Bold, Courageous, and Resilient Women. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Dr. Marissa Porges, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
There is a noisy segment of the population that likes to push this idea that there is a level playing field now for women and minority communities. But you point out in the introduction to your book that Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation report, which examined inequity around the globe, came to the conclusion that, quote, no matter where you are born, your life will be harder if you are born a girl, end quote. I mean, this is true in corporate America and education and everywhere, really, right?
It's still true across the board. We think we've come so far, and we have, but the system has a ways to go before our girls have an even playing field with their male peers.
And the premise of this book is that you say, our quote, our kids need a new set of 21st century skills. Tell us about that.
Exactly. I mean, you know, my current work running a girls' school for girls age 4 years old to 18, but also my previous career navigating mostly male dominated industries and sort of, you know, in the national security space and elsewhere. It really taught me that we need to be teaching our girls a different set of skills than we have been. The book argues that there's skills that all kids need to be, you know, impactful and empowered in the workforce and future world. But I also think that we need to give our girls a competitive advantage to help close the gap that they're currently facing in the real world. I mean, the reality is pre-pandemic, the research would say that it would take about 108 years to close the gender gap. That you see in corporate industry, in business, in education, the economy, political equality, things like that. That's gotten much worse since the pandemic. I think there's a lot of reasons we can talk to about that. But wherever you look, we need to be giving our girls things that will give them the competitive edge, personally, professionally, just, you know, throughout their lives. And so that's what I focus on in the book and my work every day.
Yeah, what I love, it's a very unexpected book. in the sense that it's evidence-based, which is great. Always love that. You have amazing stories from your life. There's an action adventure section of this book that was harrowing, quite frankly, and later we're going to get to that. You actually start the book with a scene set in the Roosevelt room at the White House and a meeting with then President Obama. Tell us what happened, or I guess more to the point, what didn't happen in that meeting.
Yeah, it's that story that I've gotten used to telling it now, but it pains me every time because it's a little bit embarrassing. It's that moment of failure that I think everyone has at some point, and it just happened to be for me at one of the most pivotal moments in my career. I'd worked long and hard to have a meeting with the leader of the free world, then President Obama, was sitting there across from the Oval Office in a small group meeting where we were talking about foreign policy, international security, Al-Qaeda, like all the things that I'd been working on for years. And in the course of the entire hour, sitting literally across the table from the president, I didn't say an entire thing. Mm. It didn't occur to me until later when I thought back to the meeting and replayed it in my head and remembered moments when I thought, oh, I'll let my friend take that. I'll let the colleague across the table take it. That I was waiting for my moment only to let the entire hour go by. And I had the good fortune of later having other opportunities with President Obama to speak my mind, to share my thoughts, and to make my voice heard. But it was such a core example of the moment where I, as a what I thought was an empowered woman, earned a seat at the table and then didn't use it effectively, didn't speak out and use my voice, that I now use it as a way to tell our girls, we need to practice, we need to work on it, we need to not just get to the table, we need to know what we do when we get there. And I think it does take practice and skill building to help ensure those moments don't happen for our girls, our peers, our friends, our mentees.
Well, and the problem too is this, it's not like this starts in adulthood. I mean, note in the book that in co-ed playgroups, boys interrupted almost three times as often as girls did. I mean,
and I think a lot of people see it, like whether it's the teachers or parents, you see it playing out. It's socialized, it's normalized. And, you know, we at an all girls school, we work against it. We try to find actual systemic ways of making sure every girl practices speaking up, practices the muscle memory that it takes to really have your voice heard, or to do all these things that we know are important in the real world. But it's just hard in an everyday way for a lot of young women, or, you know, women at any point in their lives, particularly given the systemic barriers that we often still face in most workplaces or just most everyday environments we find ourselves in.
You have a terrific practical tip in this chapter where you talk about having your girl make the call to order takeout food. That's a really, like, my wife hates doing that still to this day.
Mm-hmm. It's in a funny thing, though. I mean, and I actually borrowed that from one of the students at my school. I was interviewing one of the girls who had just exemplified what I think we all hope to see in speaking out and speaking up. She'd actually been, and it's a story I tell in the book, been sexually harassed at an area school, not our campus, a different college campus in the local Philadelphia area. And as soon as she got herself safe, as soon as she got herself out of physical danger, had the wherewithal, had the maturity at 16, 17 years old, I mean, her and her friend were there together, to literally sit down and type on their smartphones a message to the middle-aged white male who was president of that organization, to say exactly what happened, report it, and say what they think needed to happen next, which was, you know, the suggestion of having mandated, you know, sexual harassment training for all employees. And literally within 36 hours, they were sitting in the office with the director of HR and the director of security talking about the incident. And it was a moment when I just thought, how did those young women learn to do that? I mean, it's something that rarely happens. Only one out of four incidents are reported. And here we have teenage girls doing it. And when I talked to them and said, well, how did you practice? How did you learn that? The pizza, calling for pizza story came from them.
Oh, it did.
One of the girls, she actually remembers when she was, in 10 years old, that her father used to make her call for pizza. Not her brother, not her mother. She hated doing it. Was like, always felt a little uncomfortable, but she had to order pizza for the family. I mean, these days we don't pick up the phone for much, but it's a good reason to go back to the old school way of ordering takeout or whatever that moment might look like for your family. But it's just this idea that at any age we can help our girls practice the muscle memory that it takes to do the things in the real world that we all find a little bit tough sometimes.
I mean, I truly think for both of my kids, because their parents have both been steeped in improvisational pedagogy for their entire lives, and they took classes as little kids. And you know, when you are working without a script, you are sort of forced to do this. And in the next chapter, where you talk about turning her voice into an influential ask, I had this immediate memory, and I checked with my wife on this. And when Nora, our daughter, was 11, she asked for a raise in her allowance, and we said no. And then the next night, she asked if she could meet with us before we went to bed. And so she showed up at the foot of our bed, dressed in essentially her version of business clothes, with a 10-part presentation on construction paper, which is like her version of a PowerPoint, on all the reasons she should get the raise in her allowance. And we gave it to her. I mean, it was like, it was so impressive.
But that's a great example of an everyday way. It doesn't happen after all. It happen all the time. It doesn't, and the outcome doesn't have to be yes, right? The interesting right. thing there is if you had said still, you know, if it'd been, I want a dog, I want a trip, mm-hmm. I want something that's just not going to happen. The answer can still be no. I'm gonna use your yes and against you here. It can be no, but this is what I really liked in your presentation. No, but this is, you know, what works yes. so well. We can't get a dog right now. And yet, like, let's reinforce the act of asking that it escapes many women. I mean, as somebody who didn't learn to negotiate until well into their, I don't want to say 20s, but maybe 30s, it's something we all really should be practicing with our young women.
Well, and there's a double bind, too, as we all know, because, you know, when women, you know, they get penalized if they behave in the way that men do when they ask for the things that they need. Often.
Correct. Well, yes, research proves. And so there's actually research out there in terms of different ways to ask that work better for women when you negotiate in with another person, when you have help navigating the negotiating, there's someone else in the room with you, when there's somebody else who can advocate, it lessens the backlash that has been shown to happen when women negotiate. I know this is where we do need the system to change. So I think we can work on both simultaneously and hope that the next generation reaps the benefits.
Well, and I think too, like, I'm terrible at negotiating my salary. I mean, I think that is also something that is there's a human element to that as well. All right, your chapter on competition, I would love to get a little deep into this because it was really interesting because you're framing, you basically suggest the framing that all competition is bad is a detriment to girls and women. Tell us your thesis there.
So I think that over time, competition has sort of taken on, become a bad word, not a four-letter bad word, but close enough for a lot of parents who think, who align competition with cheating, with not being able to lose gracefully, or with just sort of, you know, what we call maladaptive competitiveness, sort of the bad side of it, the things that we don't encourage in kids that we want to treat each other nicely and be good citizens. I think this is particularly detrimental to young women. And it plays out in girls who, for social reasons, are taught to want to share, want to be compassionate, be good friends. That is what's rewarded in the social structures in schools and in other places. When you combine those two ideas, you see that in a lot of environments, girls are not encouraged to lean into their competitive nature, to want to win, not at all costs, but win because it means being your best. It's part of the reason why, and there's a couple of reasons at play, but it's one reason why by middle school, girls are likely to opt out of competitive sports twice as often as boys. And that we see the same thing play out through high school, such that by the end of high school, 50% of women have, you know, young women have opted out of those team sports that they could play at school. And yet we all know that the things you learn in those environments, it's about being your best, performing your best, being okay with winning and losing. And also things like resilience and team spirit that really make a difference in the working world and in the professional sphere that rewards a competitive nature, that rewards, you know, trying your best and going, putting yourself out there. And, you know, it's also why even things like the political arena, a lot of women are turned off by the highly competitive nature of politics. And, you know, we think we're doing better in that. And we're fortunate to now have a female VP, you know, a good sign of gender parity, things moving in the right direction. And yet Congress is still less, you know, about 26% female. Right? We're not making that great of a gain in these areas. And there's a lot of things at play. But I do think in part it's because we've given our kids and especially our girls a sense that being competitive is, you know, too far against the grain and not something to be encouraged.
And I thought it was interesting that the science goes way back on here. When you introduce us to a late 19th century social scientist by the name of Norman Triplett, who's from Illinois, this was fascinating. Tell us about this guy and his studies.
Oh, when I stumbled upon this story, I just kept digging into his biography, into the story. And literally, it's one of the first individuals to do a natural experiment. And he sort of started this vein of this line of research for social scientists where he just, you know, sort of looked at children in their own environment. He actually started looking at bike races to see how people compete in bike races. And he developed it over time and then did an experiment with kids where they, you know, you played with a fishing rod and fishing reel and sort of how quickly they were able to get something on the line and wind it to its end. And it was proven in that environment and a lot of other places that when you compete against, when you do a game against somebody, when you sort of you race next to somebody, when you do this fishing rod experiment with someone beside you and they're doing it as well, you, and whether it's because you work a little higher, your energy is up, your spirit is up, you perform better, you go faster. Mm-hmm. Even if you still don't win, your personal best is better. And, you know, it's something that I'm sure every parent or every individual who sort of has spent time on, you know, whether it's a basketball court or the tennis court or just sort of any place where you sort of feel that spirit, it could be something, you know, like throwing your hat in the ring to get a part in a play or an improv stage too.
Yep.
In those moments, we sort of put ourselves out there in ways that bring out our best. And so this scientist, Norm Triplett, he aligned his work with kids as a teacher and his social science research to figure out that, again, being competitive is a good thing. Being competitive is a good thing for girls. And he actually proved that for young women as well, perform better when they compete.
Yeah. Nora was the only female member of the boys' flag football team. And the other moms just were like so in love with her because it was such a badass move. And she played all the, you know, she played soccer and basketball and volleyball and all that stuff. And it wasn't easy because there'd be lots of tears after losing and that sort of thing. But when I read the chapter, and I was an athlete when I was younger too, and I do think it, you don't get to the place of learning to lose with generosity and grace until you've lost with the opposite. Mm-hmm. I think in the same way that, you know, we learn through our mistakes. We don't learn from our successes. We learn from our mistakes if we're at all doing it right.
Yep. Yeah. So those moments are true learning moments. But I also think that in those moments when she was on the field with the guys playing flag football or any environment where sort of she had to toughen up, you know, be her best, learn, you know, yeah, she figured out how to lose with some heartache probably over time. I think she developed a tool, a skill set that, she, you know, probably counted on in more places than you realize. I mean, for me, and this is the story I tell in the book, is I pulled on my competitive spirit very, very clearly when I was in the Navy. And I didn't know it until looking back on it when I started writing this book and talking to other female colleagues and friends in different places I'd worked. And it was actually my colleague from the White House who started talking about it. One of the reasons why she was so successful in the West, you know, in the environment of the West Wing and in finance and in a lot of like male dominated places was she's like, I'm competitive. I want to win. Mm-hmm. I want to be my best. And that's okay. And I use it to my advantage. And it made me really reflect on, for me, when I was particularly going through hard times in the Navy and trying to figure out, you know, for me, it was moments when I was flying and it was sort of struggling with some stuff. And I dug into being competitive. I wouldn't let the guys win. I wasn't going to let that happen. And, you know, it's I think, a way to pull, you know, build on your resilience. It's another tool that you can pull on to develop this kind of generalized idea of resilience that I think is hard for us to figure out how to teach. And I do think being, you know, leaning into your competitive nature in a healthy way can help on that.
Yeah, I think your myth busting on the word is important because it's similar to stress. Right? Stress is not a bad thing or a good thing. You need stress to get to peak performance.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. I'm going to borrow that one, Kelly. So
please borrow that. All right. Speaking of stressful, can you tell us a bit of the story that opens chapter four? Because you're in a jet circling over the Western Pacific and you need to unload 10,000 gallons of fuel. And it's like, it's not going well.
Yes. So this is one of those moments when that I didn't tell my mother about until years later. I think until she read the book, she didn't really know the full story. And it was a harrowing moment for me. And when I was flying for the U.S. Navy, it was particularly harrowing because we were the pilot. I was a navigator, weapons officer, and had two other people in the jet with me. And we were all like green as whatever the greenest thing we could think of right now. We had no idea what we were doing, in other words. You know, these are the missions where you're going out, you're training, you're pushing yourself. And it was a night mission where we needed extra fuel. We needed to be able to land. We were nowhere near dry land, nowhere near our aircraft carrier. And we could not figure out what was wrong with it. Some things started going wrong with the plane that we made us not be able to take on fuel. But again, we got through it. And, you know, there's a lot in the book about how we got through it, what happened next, and how we were able to land safely. But when I started doing research for the book in terms of how women in particular collaborate and how we problem solve and sort of how we have been socialized to do things a little bit differently than a lot of our male peers, this story all of a sudden came to mind because it was one of the few times that I was in the jet with another female aviator. There weren't very many of us flying at the time. There's more now, but still not that many. And I happened to be in the plane that night with my roommate from the aircraft carrier, a friend who I'd, you know, been in flight school with and served in the and deployed with. And when I called her to ask about that night, and we spent an hour on the phone talking it through many years later, trying to piece together what had happened, it occurred to me that while we followed the instructions on our emergency manual for what to do next to avoid literally having to eject in the middle of the ocean to save ourselves and not our plane, what I realized was happening was that between the lines, we were doing things differently as women because of how we communicated with each other, how we managed emotions, how we managed the emotions of our pilot, who was super nervous. He was young and new too, and we were trying to figure out how to, you know, land safely and survive. And I think we got through it differently. I'm not going to say necessarily better, but it worked out. So it was a successful mission overall. But we definitely tackled what we were facing together much differently because we were both women than if I had been with a man in the plane or if there had been no women in the jet that night. So this is where I started piecing apart for looking at more research that shows we women do bring to the table different skills that I think are advantages when it comes to communicating, problem solving and collaborating, which of course, you know, everyone needs in the workplace these days.
Yeah, and so fundamental to our work. And I was thinking when I started at Second City, like the training center was probably 70% male and 30% female. And I was in a meeting yesterday and we are now 60% female, 40% male.
That's amazing. And I wonder if you're thinking about it, has the dynamic changed in terms of how the group functions over time? Because there's more women in the room.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I also give a lot of credit to like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and these, there was a certain point when they left Second City and showed up on Saturday Night Live and they were the best people in the cast and Maya Rudolph and Rachel Dratch. And it was like, they weren't talking about the men and they really talked, both wrote books about how their being steeped in the philosophy of improvisation gave them a practice in knowing how to sort of play well with others. And I think women in general, my wife talks about this a lot because she's a comedy professor, is that Tina is a master at understanding all the different kind of status games that are going on. Mm-hmm. And so she can play with an Alec Baldwin's ego and set it up to work for the sort of comedic way it needs to work for the show, probably serving him personally as well, while not necessarily surrendering her power because she's actually in charge. That's a card trick.
Well, and that's masterful, right? And it's actually something that plays into, I get asked a lot about this, you know, how do you work with the ego in the room if you're a woman and a man, you know, what does that look like? So you're not disempowered, but you're not creating an antagonistic environment. And I always answer with, I use humor. Now, I don't use Tina Fey humor, right? Never gonna, not that level, but I think we each have sort of like that trick, that statement, that thing that can, take the air out of the, you know, a room in a good way and just move it forward. I think humor can be incredibly powerful, but it's an interesting thing to think that women need to use it differently sometimes in the room and can be do it so at such an impactful level. That's cool.
Well, and your using of humor is an element of what's also discussed in this chapter, which is being in a state of play has been sort of shown to be an effective way for people to navigate and tolerate risk and all that. And I think, you know, what's, I don't know if you know this, but like the very first studies, like serious studies of improvisation, were done on aircraft carriers.
I had no idea. No, yeah, I've not heard of that.
Carl Weick out of the University of Michigan, who's a very esteemed academic, was basically talking about the ways in which you had to sort of make decisions in the moment and changes and communicate. And, you know, it was acts of true improvisation. And so then the deepest study of improvisation is all in areas of risk and like after huge accidents, nuclear power plants going down. And I think that probably freaks people out because you feel like, well, at these really serious moments, you don't want people improvising. It's like, no, that's when you need them to be able to improvise.
Yeah. And what an edgy way to think about it, but so accurate because, I hadn't thought of it through the lens of improvisation, but there are certain things that we used to do on the carrier to feed the nature of play into what you're doing. And it was playing certain music before you walked to the jet. It was certain things you did and you called it tradition, but it was really to put everyone in a certain frame of mind that like after you went through the emergency procedures and after you did all the stuff that would, no kidding, make sure you could, get out of there alive, so to speak. You then had to enter yourself into a different state to make sure it went well, right? You had to play with it a bit. But it's interesting to think, and I hadn't thought of it this way, that it was in part to push ourselves into a different level of risk taking. But able to think differently and manage a situation effectively.
Another, like the aspect of someone, opting this for a movie, they could, because you have a scene where you're having breakfast with an ex-Al-Qaeda operative to hear stories about his life as a terrorist, and you reveal something about yourself that like actually could have put you in real danger. That was like a calculated revelation.
So this is that stage of my career where I was doing a lot of counterterrorism work for the U.S. government, but also research overseas and in Yemen and Afghanistan and lots of places where Al-Qaeda at the time was the leading terrorist organization we were concerned about. And I did find myself across the table with a lot of former terrorists or people of concern. And in this one particular breakfast session I had, I was interviewing the former leading recruiter for Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And he was sharing stories when he had been with Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora and sort of his story of how as a young man, he joined Al-Qaeda. I was trying to break through to the other side. I was trying to really develop a connection with him. And in the same way that I'm sure for comedians having to get personal, right? That moment where you can sort of break through and make a personal connection is when you sort of tread new ground together and can make headway. He turned the tables on me and, wanted to ask about my religion. We started talking about religion and family. And before I knew it, he was trying to push me to divulge information. And I don't do it often. And I do it very carefully, obviously, in these moments. I dodged and dodged. And I finally told him that I was Jewish. And so here I am, a Jewish American woman in Sana'a, Yemen, the capital of Yemen, shortly after there had been a major Al-Qaeda attack, 4 days after. And I can still feel the gaze, the glare rather, of my interpreter. I was there with an interpreter who, was just horrified that I would share this information. Mm-hmm. And there was a beat where we didn't know what was going to happen next. And he started laughing, right? He thought it was kind of funny in part because he'd never met a Jew. He said, oh my goodness, tell me stories. What's it like? He wanted to know more about it. It was this unique creature to him. So I guess there's a combination of taking risk and, but also really the story for me was, trying to develop a connection through empathetic thinking, right? And really using that idea of how you build, to take someone else's perspective into account, you have to be able to step into their shoes. And for me, that's what that was, as a way to build a connection. I do think getting back to the book, it's something that girls in particular do well. I see it here at my school. I've seen it throughout my career. And again, it's something that I think we should help them develop and lean into to really be, effective leaders and effective game changers wherever they go next.
Well, I've talked about this in the pod too. The work we have done at the University of Chicago with the behavioral sciences community, one of the exercises we developed was all about getting people to share, and that doesn't even have to be deep personal details, some personal details about themselves, because we suspect in our minds that people don't want to hear that when in fact the opposite is true. And even these minor connections can create incredible like pathways to relationships. Like we did this when Nora was in the hospital. We like, because you have so many different nurses and doctors. So the minute they'd walk in the room, we'd be like, Her name is Eleanor, but she also goes by Nora. She's got a 100-pound Bernese Mountain Dog named Benchley, who's kind of an asshole. And we live in Ravenswood Manor in Chicago. What's your deal?
Mm-hmm.
And instantly, they're caught off a little guard, and then they reveal.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I love that part of the story was the dog. That is exactly the same trick I used to do when I was traveling throughout the Middle East and trying to build connection with these individuals I was interviewing, in large part because everyone can relate to a pet. No matter what country you're in, sometimes I would change the pet. Literally, I would talk about my cat in the Middle East more than my dog, because in the Middle East, there is traditions about cats versus dogs. And I had on my iPhone pictures of the cat. And particularly if there was young people in the room and I was doing interviews, I would call them over and take out my phone and show them pictures of my pets, because it just created this sense of your humanity and connection in a way
you become
that
human. Mm-hmm. So instantly you're human, which changes the equation.
Correct.
Wow. Yep. And this is like, the way we're talking in our country right now, right? I mean, it is so much that, and this overwhelming need for empathy. Mm-hmm. We are at a deficit right now, both young people and older people.
Yeah. And then this is where it all comes together. And we look at research that shows young people now have less are less empathetic than previous generations. So on one hand, it's a over time generational change. And on the other hand, we just see what's happening playing out. And I think we're all losing this ability to connect and empathize with each other on a daily basis in a real way. And that's really what we need to be able to do to move forward, because the problems we're facing as a society, as a country, as a world require, whether it's, inequities, climate change, whatever you're looking for, right? The answers need to lie in collaboration and finding middle ground and things like that. And this is where my stump speech ends with, girls are the future, because these are girls' strengths. This is where women historically, socially, normally, are generally speaking, but research bears it out, do really well. And so we want to encourage it in our young women.
Yeah, I'm so shocked that Second City, while the theaters are shut down and it's tragic and so many people aren't working, our corporate division is getting a fair amount of work, and it's not the traditional work. It is all about resilience and adaptability and agility and change readiness. So we will lead workshops on Zoom, but what we'll also do is host people's meetings and bring music in and do performance and add in video elements just to sort of change up the day for folks, but also then give them some stuff that they can kind of take with them. Mm-hmm. Because it is, I mean, this is, I had an in-person meeting at Second City yesterday, which is the first one since March.
Can you imagine, right? How have we gone so long without that feeling of connectedness?
No, it was, even though we're all masked and we're 6 feet apart and it was just about 15 of us. Mm-hmm. I was both happy and sad. I was happy because I had that opportunity and I felt charged after the day, and I had therapy last night. So I talked about this with my therapist, because there was also a bit of me that was like, we are missing and have missed so much.
It's making everything harder. I have to say, we have the good fortune here at school. We've been open for in-person learning for most of the year. And so I get to come to school and see the kids, and we're all far apart, we're wearing masks, but there's a different energy when you're in a space with other people that you lose when we're distant and doing everything virtually. So even though it works to keep the trains moving, it doesn't work to, make the connections that I think we need to now.
You guys do temperature checking and stuff too?
We do everything. Oh my goodness.
It's more everything.
Yes, you have to. I mean, we want to keep our teachers safe. We want to keep the kids safe. So yes,
I think so I know Nora's old school, Chicago Waldorf, is open, and mm-hmm. and but I think Waldorf schools and your school have maybe more options to them than the battle right now, as in Chicago, is they don't know what to do. And I don't see a good answer here.
There's not. There's not a good answer. And we do have the good fortune of having resources at our disposal and a lot of support from our parent community to think of flexible new ways of doing things, and technology and temperature checks and all this stuff. It is still hard. It is still impossible. There's no good answer here. So
yeah, I downtown Philly probably has the same problem, right? With the public schools. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere by saying no. And actually, you don't get that far by saying yes. We say you should say yes and affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Oh, I have a lot of yes and stories. I'll use the, I have the good fortune of having led a career of yes ands, which is why I've jumped around so much. And the most recent one, which is the yes and that took me from the West Wing of the White House, where I was when I got a phone call to see if I'd be interested in returning to the school that I once graduated from and becoming a head of school for a fantastic all-girls school. And I remember running downstairs to my then work sister, if you know that term, right? Mm-hmm. The person you count on and saying, I got this crazy call. It'll never happen. This is, who's been thinking, what are they thinking of? And she said, oh, you'll totally do it. And I said, yes, and to the interviews and the process. And here I am. I'm now running a school in a pandemic, so I have some good fodder for a lot of sitcoms to follow. But besides that, I've had the good fortune of, realizing what I think we need to do for our next generation of young women and preparing them to take over the world. So I think that would be my yes and.
Yeah, and the yes and also has to be the book. I mean, that's yes. you wouldn't have written this if you weren't in the position. It's like you can sort of see the thread of you weaving together all your lives a little bit to find this moment in a place of lovely sort of reflection. It's really, it's a beautiful book. It's called What Girls Need, How to Raise Bold, Courageous, and Resilient Women. Dr. Marissa Porges, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.